Imagine looking at a photograph of like one of the busiest streets in Paris,
Right.
and the year is 1839. So you'd think this should be a completely chaotic scene, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
You have dozens of horse-drawn carriages, street vendors screaming, just hundreds of people rushing to work. But the street in this picture is completely
Empty.
empty, like a total ghost town. Except for this one single guy standing entirely motionless on a corner getting his boots shined.
Yeah, and that image is actually famously known as the first photograph to ever capture a human being.
Right. But it's also a massive lie, isn't it?
Oh, completely.
Because the street wasn't actually empty at all. The
Yeah.
camera just basically deleted everyone who was moving. And that idea, that a camera can tell this faithful technical truth while getting the actual facts completely wrong is exactly what we're diving into today.
We are. And our guide for this deep dive is Roger Morrow. He's the editor and publisher of the Beaver County Almanac. And he wrote this profoundly fascinating, honestly, sometimes hilarious, and deeply personal essay called The Great Photography Scam.
The great photography scam. Okay, let's unpack this. Because, I mean, if you look at your own phone right now, you probably have, what, thousands of photos?
Oh, at least tens of thousands for some people.
Right. And we treat those photos as undeniable proof of our lives. But Morrow is arguing that from that very first ghost town photo in Paris, all the way to our modern, AI-enhanced camera rolls, photography fundamentally alters our relationship with reality.
With reality, with time, and with memory, yeah.
Exactly.
And what's great is Morrow approaches this not as some cranky tech critic, you know.
Yeah.
He's a guy whose entire life has been steeped in photography.
Right, he knows his stuff.
He grew up surrounded by those heavy, expensive mechanical cameras of the 1970s, and now he's observing this current era of just weightless digital images.
So how does he actually arrive at this idea of a scam? Because usually when we think of someone growing up around cameras, we think of this noble pursuit of truth or art.
Well, Morrow's introduction to the camera was very different. For his father, the camera wasn't just an art tool, it was social utility.
A social utility.
Yeah, like a status symbol. Morrow actually jokes that his father was this skilled amateur who basically kept the Eastman Kodak Company solvent in Chippewa Township.
That's amazing.
And he eventually bought a Leica Flex.
Okay, I have to ask, what makes a Leica Flex so special? Like, why not just a regular camera?
So, a Leica Flex in the 1970s was a piece of serious German engineering. It was heavy, it was complex, and incredibly expensive.
Oh, I see.
It commanded respect. Morrow says it was the kind of camera that announced its seriousness before anyone even removed the lens cap.
Right, it's a statement piece.
Exactly. His father actually became the president of the Beaver Valley Camera Club.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they used to host these elaborate summer outings by their swimming pool, which was a pretty big deal in Beaver County back then.
I was actually reading that part of his essay, and the scene he paints is just so vivid. You've got catered food, local bikini models posing by the water,
Yeah.
and you have all these husbands wandering around very seriously adjusting their aperture settings.
Right, while the wives sat nearby, watching with, as he puts it, grave composure.
I love that phrase, grave composure.
Because they were totally aware of what the husbands were really doing and mentally preparing to discuss it on the drive
Oh,
home.
absolutely.
And Morrow's mother is the one silently paying those massive film development bills. He has this great line where he says, "You know, the great masters had patrons, but his father had his mother."
That's so good. But what I find really fascinating here is the psychological function of that Leica Flex. Yes, his dad won awards, he had a good eye, sure. But relatives started noticing that the camera was a really convenient way to avoid small talk at family gatherings.
Oh, it was the perfect alibi.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have this intimidating machine pressed to your eye, you don't have to listen to a distant cousin complain about their gallbladder.
Right, you just.
You can just squint, study the lighting, make a minor adjustment, and literally just slowly back away.
It acts like a social invisibility cloak. I mean, it gives you a highly respected, official reason to be in a room, but completely exempts you from the messy reality of having to actually interact with anyone in it.
Exactly. You get to shield yourself from the occasion while pretending you're preserving it.
Wow.
And Morrow absorbed that lesson completely. When he went away to this all-male prep school in New Jersey, he didn't care about the technical mastery. He treated the camera like an electric guitar.
Meaning he just carried it around to look cool.
Precisely. He admits that ignorance never stopped a prep school boy from adopting an aesthetic position.
Right, naturally.
So he carried a camera, hoping people would mistake possession of the instrument for actual talent. He'd photograph a mud puddle and claim the reflections looked like, an LSD
Or a
trip.
backdrop for a Jefferson Airplane concert.
Exactly.
Did he ever actually learn the real mechanics, though?
He did, mostly thanks to a friend named Phil Ulanovsky. So Phil played in the school rock band, but his real domain was the dark room.
The inner sanctum.
Right, he understood the chemicals, the red safe lights, and together they would just drive around Beaver County photographing disappearing farmhouses and sagging barns. They felt they were preserving history.
You know, it makes me wonder about our own habits today. Like, you go to a party now and pull out your phone to take a video. Are you actually preserving the memory, or are you just using the phone as a shield because you feel socially awkward?
That's a great question.
Like, does buying a massive, $4,800 lens today serve the exact same psychological function as Morrow carrying around that camera in prep school just to look edgy?
Mara would argue it absolutely does. The camera industry has spent two centuries selling us this idea that buying better equipment equals developing a better artistic eye.
Right.
But the machine only gives you confidence, it doesn't give you vision. And believing that the machine can do the work of seeing is basically the gateway to the core scam of photography.
Okay, let's get into that core scam. Because this idea that a photograph captures reality, I mean, on a basic level, I look at a picture of my dog, and that is my dog.
Right.
How is that a scam?
Because a photograph makes a very specific promise. It says, "This farmhouse stood exactly here. This family sat together looking perfectly happy on a Tuesday afternoon."
Okay.
But Morrow argues the camera doesn't preserve a moment. It preserves the appearance of a fraction of a second. The moment itself goes right on vanishing.
It's tricky because photographs feel like undeniable proof. Like if someone paints a portrait of me, I know they might have made my nose look a little better or, changed the lighting. I know a human brain interpreted that.
Right, a painting admits it's an interpretation,
Yeah.
but a photograph arrives wearing what Morrow calls the uniform of evidence.
The uniform of evidence.
It speaks with the confidence of a courthouse clerk declaring, "This is what happened." But what actually happened is just whatever light bounced into a rectangular box during the 125th of a second when nobody happened to be blinking.
Which brings us back to that empty Paris street in 1839.
Yes.
How did that happen? Why was the street empty if it was actually packed with people?
So to understand that, we really have to look at how early photography worked.
Oh.
Long before film, Renaissance artists used something called a camera obscura.
Okay, I've heard of that.
It was basically a dark box with a pinhole. Light from the outside world would shine through the pinhole and project an upside-down image on the back wall of the box, and artists would trace it.
Right, so the light is casting an image, but it doesn't stick. It's just a projection.
Exactly. The visible world refused to leave a permanent print. Until the 1820s, when this French inventor named Joseph Nicéphore Niépce figured out a chemical solution.
What does he do?
He took a pewter plate, coated it with a naturally occurring asphalt called bitumen, and stuck it inside one of these camera obscuras.
Wait, asphalt? What does the asphalt do?
So bitumen hardens when it's exposed to light. So the areas of the plate hit by bright light from the sky would harden, and the dark shadow areas would stay soft and could be washed away later. And that leaves a permanent image. But here's the catch. Light is essentially made of tiny packets of energy called photons, right?
Right.
In 1826, the chemical coating was so insensitive that it required millions of photons hitting the exact same spot over a massive amount of time just to cause that hardening reaction.
How much time are we talking about here?
About 8 hours.
8 hours
Oh.
for one photo.
Yes, 8 hours. Niépce pointed his camera out his window at an estate in France. But because the exposure took 8 hours, the sun literally crossed the sky.
Oh, so the shadows moved.
Exactly. In
Yeah.
the final image, opposite sides of the buildings are illuminated. Morrow actually points out that it's less a snapshot than a geological survey.
Okay, so that totally explains the empty Paris street a decade later. The guy taking it, Louis Daguerre, he must have sped the chemistry up a bit, but just not enough to freeze motion.
Precisely. By 1839, Daguerre gets the exposure time down to about 10 or 15 minutes.
It's a long time.
Yeah, but the mechanism is the same. Photons have to continually hit the plate to register an image. A carriage moving down the street doesn't stay in one place long enough to reflect enough photons onto any single spot on the plate.
So it leaves no trace. It just vanishes.
It completely vanishes.
But the guy getting his boot shined, he stood completely still for 10 minutes.
Right.
So enough photons from his body hit the plate, to burn his image into the chemicals.
That is the only reason he is in the photo. The camera faithfully recorded exactly what the light did, but it produced an image of Paris that was a complete fiction.
Man, here's where it gets really interesting, though, and I want to push back a little on this definition of a lie.
Okay, go for it.
Because if Daguerre's camera mathematically captured exactly what the ambient light did over 15 minutes, isn't that actually a truer representation of time passing than our modern freezing of a fraction of a second?
Hmm.
I mean, light doesn't naturally freeze time.
Hmm.
So is the lie really the camera's fault? Or is it our flawed expectation of what a photo is supposed to be?
That is a brilliant distinction. The lie is absolutely in our expectation. But Morrow reminds us that this expectation was aggressively manufactured by the industry.
How so?
Well, when George Eastman created Kodak, he wanted to sell cameras to ordinary people. The famous slogan was, "You press the button, we do the rest."
Which completely changed the game. I mean, you no longer had to understand chemicals or photons or wait 8 hours.
Right. But that slogan concealed a deeper consequence. You press the button, Kodak develops the film, but time does the rest. By making it so effortless to capture the appearance of a moment, the machine made us forget that the moment itself was still slipping away.
And as the technology progressed, right, from those early Kodaks to Polaroids and eventually digital cameras, we just stripped away all the friction.
Every bit of it.
Which leads right into Morrow's critique of our modern era. Because now, we aren't just freezing a fraction of a second, we are actively altering reality before we even experience it.
Yes. He brings in cultural critic Susan Sontag, who was writing about this back in the 1970s. She observed that photography had become a way of collecting the world.
Collecting the world, yeah.
Like, you don't just visit the Grand Canyon to experience its vastness. You turn your back to the Grand Canyon so it can serve as a prop behind your own face.
You reduce geological time to background scenery just to prove you were there.
Exactly.
And with smartphones, I mean, this is mutated into an absolute obsession.
Mm-hmm.
Morrow gives these incredibly relatable examples, like parents at a school play watching their kids' one and only third grade performance through a 5-inch screen, recording a video they will never, ever watch again.
Never.
Or, you know, a dinner where the food gets cold while someone leans over the table trying to find the perfect angle for their avocado toast.
Right. Photography used to be reserved for documenting exceptional events, but now we're in an era where events only occur so that they can be photographed.
It's like outsourcing your own life. It's like, imagine eating at a Michelin star restaurant.
Right.
But you insist on chewing everything through a plastic bag.
Oh, wow.
Like, you're officially certifying the experience. You have the proof you ate there, but you are actively preventing yourself from tasting it. We are sacrificing the living of a moment just to secure the documentation of it.
And the cruel irony, Morrow points out, is that this digital documentation we sacrifice our lives for isn't even permanent.
Right.
Think about his father's pool parties. Shooting film yielded a physical object, a negative. A printed photo could sit in a drawer and be discovered by a grandchild half a century later.
But today, we shoot digital photos that just float away into the cloud.
Right. And what is the cloud? It's just servers run by tech corporations, bound by terms of service none of us ever read.
Exactly.
Forever in the digital age just means until we lose the password, or our subscription lapses, or the server farm fails.
Or until our heirs decide they really don't want 43,000 identical burst photos of our dog.
Exactly. We possess more images than any civilization in human history, but we might leave the fewest recoverable ones behind.
Not to mention, the photos we are storing aren't even optically real anymore.
No, they aren't.
Modern smartphone cameras use computational AI. They aren't just passively letting photons hit a sensor. The millisecond you press the button, the computer inside your phone takes multiple exposures at different light levels.
Right.
It analyzes the scene. It probabilistically guesses what should be there. It brightens the shadows, smooths the skin, and stitches it all together. It's literally creating a synthetic reality. It brightens the sunset before the actual sunset even has a chance to disappoint us.
We are basically handed an image of the world as if reality had hired a better lighting director.
Yes.
The camera sees several possible worlds, merges them, and gives us the most flattering one.
I mean, knowing all of this, that the medium cheats, that it substitutes possession for attention,
right,
that our phones are literally inventing pixels that didn't exist, it really makes you want to just throw your phone in a river.
It does.
But Morrow makes a huge pivot here. Because after laying out this airtight case against the photography scam, he admits a pretty embarrassing personal weakness.
He still takes pictures.
He still takes pictures. Why?
Because despite the deception, photography occasionally captures profound truths that our normal biological sight just misses.
Okay, how so?
Well, Mauro learned this by spending time with people who treat photography very differently than the rest of us.
Like David Hume Kennerly.
Yes. So when Mauro was a young speechwriter, he was interning at the White House under President Gerald Ford.
Okay.
And he worked around Kennerly, who was the official White House photographer. Kennerly was already a legend for his combat photography.
Right.
And what Mauro observed was that a speechwriter's job is to supply language to control a moment. But a great photographer waits for the moment that language cannot control.
The unguarded instant.
Right. The sudden fatigue in a politician's face or a specific glance across a briefing room that betrays the official narrative. Kennerly wasn't manufacturing reality. He was ambushing the truth.
Ambushing the truth. I love that. And Mauro saw a totally different approach to truth years later on a trip to New Zealand, right?
He did. He was working on a corporate annual report and traveling with a photographer named Stephen Wilkes. They were shooting some major figures like Sir Edmund Hillary and even Peter Gabriel.
Right.
What Wilkes taught Mauro was the power of extreme patience.
Okay.
Most of us just snatch a photo out of time on our way somewhere else, but Wilkes would meticulously compose a frame and just wait. A truly decisive moment requires a level of sustained concentration that most people can't even muster while waiting in line at the grocery store.
It reminds me of the third photographer he brings up, his friend from Beaver County, Emmanuel Panagiotakis.
Oh, yes!
Emmanuel calls himself a light chaser. And I just love the explanation behind that name.
It's beautiful.
Right, because light is constantly leaving. It hits the side of a barn or illuminates a face, and then the earth rotates and the light moves on.
Hmm.
A photographer chases it specifically because it can never be stopped.
And when they do manage to freeze that light, they often catch things they didn't even know they were looking at.
Which leads to, honestly, what might be Mauro's most moving point.
Yeah, borrowing a concept from the French philosopher Roland Barthes.
Right.
Barthes wrote extensively about the psychology of images, specifically something he called the accidental detail.
This is the part of the essay that really got me. What exactly is the accidental detail?
It's the thing in the photograph that the photographer wasn't actually trying to capture, but that ends up carrying all the emotional weight years later.
Oh, wow.
Mauro talks about looking back at those old slides of his father's pool parties. He isn't looking at the bikini models or the catered food in the center of the frame. He's looking at the edges.
The edges.
Yeah.
Right? He sees his mother standing off to the side. He sees his father's camera resting on a patio table. He notices someone sitting in a deck chair whose name he has completely forgotten.
Exactly. And the emotional weight comes from the innocence of the people in the picture.
The innocent.
Think about it. The people frozen in that 1970s summer afternoon are completely innocent of the future. They have no idea what's going to happen to their marriages or their houses or their health. They don't know who is going to die first.
It's chilling because we, looking at the photo decades later, we know the ending.
Right.
They can't see forward. And we can't go back.
Mauro calls it the cruelty hidden inside the miracle. The photograph brings that exact, perfect Kodak blue sky close enough to see, but keeps it forever out of reach.
Yeah.
When young Roger and his friend Phil were photographing those sagging Beaver County farmhouses, they thought they were preserving them, but they were actually just documenting their departure.
Because it's already gone.
Exactly. The baby in a photo is gone forever, even if the adult they become is standing right next to you.
So what does this all mean then? If every photograph is basically a tiny memorial to a dead moment, is taking a picture an act of optimism? Like, are we saying this mattered? Or is it an act of mourning where we are admitting this is already gone?
Mauro concludes that it's inextricably both. It fixes the light and loses the life.
Wow.
It's a scam because it can't deliver eternity. But it's a gift because it offers this fragile fragment of evidence that the visible world once arranged itself in exactly this way. And that someone, whether they were vain or lonely or just deeply observant, cared enough to press the button.
We've covered a lot of ground tracing Roger Mauro's deeply personal exploration today. I mean, we started with his father using a heavy Leica Flex as a social shield and traveled back to the chemical photon gathering that resulted in history's first photographic lies in Paris.
We really did.
And we've unpacked how modern AI and digital clouds are actively replacing our biological memories with probabilistic synthetic pixels.
Right.
Yet despite the medium cheating and beautifying falsehoods, The accidental details trapped at the edges of the frame remain these incredibly powerful, heartbreaking gifts.
They do. So the next time you find yourself scrolling through your own camera roll, I encourage you to look past the posed smiles in the dead center.
Yeah, look past the obvious stuff.
Look at the edges of the frame. Look for the crooked necktie, the half-eaten sandwich on the counter, the specific slant of sunlight on a wall that was just about to vanish forever. Look for the accidental detail.
Which leaves us with a final, somewhat unsettling question to ponder on your own.
Oh, boy.
If our modern smartphone cameras are now computational, right, automatically generating pixels to combine multiple exposures and give us a reality that never actually happened but plausibly could have.
Right.
What happens to the accidental details of the future? 100 years from now, when our descendants finally crack the password to our digital clouds, will they be looking at memorials of our actual messy lives or just beautifully lit hallucinations of the people we wished we were?